And being a tobacconist, he decided to locate in Connecticut, which was a tobacco-growing state at that time. And so he was elected to the Board of Aldermen, and when they drew the fire wagons by hand, not by even horses, he had a marvelous library, Schiller and Heine and all the classics. He was a remarkable person. But when I knew him, he'd already had a stroke, and he wasn't. I couldn't discuss things with him because he was able to discuss. All I knew was the history.
But so there was a tradition of radicalism in your family.
There was a tradition of nonconformism. I wouldn't call it radicalism. Nonconformism. My aunt was very active in the women's suffrage movement and marched with the women with the straw hats. I remembered the procession, Dr. Shaw and that whole group.
Were you ever involved at all in the suffrage
struggle?
Well,
that was too early. I was only a child.
Mm-hmm. But towards the end there, at the end of the war?
Well, when the suffragette movement came from England to the United States, and I was in New York even before I was married, when I was studying there. See, we had this whole group there at that time. I told you, Lillian Wald and Eleanor Roosevelt and that whole Frances Perkins and the beginning of that whole movement.
Is it, do you want to eat now? I've got it ready, but I'm just...
So where are we? And I told you, in New York, I worked with the Cooperative League, and I got into the International Cooperative Movement.
Oh,
it rounded up the whole thing.
Tell me about what the suffrage movement was going on when you were in New York and the Lillian Wald connections.
I think that period had already passed. I know that in Louisville we had the women voted for the school board, but we didn't have the vote until 1932 in federal elections in New York. No, we had no vote.
1920.
The first election that I could vote in New York was 15 Debs. And that was in 1932.
No, it would be 20...
Well, we weren't there. No, we were. We went there in 18. Well, anyway,
mm-hmm.
The suffrage movement was over
mm-hmm.
by the time I got to New York.
Now, when did your husband, did you move to New York with your husband, or did he die?
He died in 23, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you moved to New York in
18, I guess it was.
And that's when you then first took the job with the joint.
That's when I studied at Columbia
mm-hmm.
in the graduate school, and then took that 6 week course, and then went to the New School of Social Research, and then went into the... In fact, before I went into the ladies' garment workers thing, I got a job with the Amalgamated Turning Vests, and I was a member of the Amalgamated Clothing
Makers.
Under Hilma, and yeah, I worked in the
mm-hmm.
shop. Under Hillman and Potosky. Not for long, but
mm-hmm.
to get the feeling of the thing.
In other words, to see, was this before you were on that joint board? Or after?
Yes, before.
And it was primarily to get a feeling for the condition?
Well, I wanted to see what was going on and put myself in the position of a employee. And it was very interesting, you know. I had learned all this technical stuff about how to be efficient and how to do this and that, so I started to put to put that into use so that by 4 o'clock I wouldn't be over my head. And I was resented by the other workers because I was speeding up. So at 4 o'clock, when I should have been letting down, the foreman would dump bundles of new stuff for me to do, you see. And I was so incensed over the thing that I told him I was going to quit. And so he offered me, you know, more money, you're a good worker. And I said, no, you've demonstrated, you know. So I walked off the job.
Now, how long did you work then?
Oh, I don't think it was more than a couple of months. But I got the feel of what was going on. It was turning vests, that was what I was doing.
And what were the conditions like in that shop compared to the shops you later saw?
The Amalgamated shop was much better. It was a men's. Mostly men and women, but it was entirely different. It wasn't subjected to fumes and things. It was machine. We turned the vests and inside out and got them ready for the machine operators. It was not the same kind of shop. The conditions were entirely different.
So they were much better than in the ILGW?
Oh, different thing. Mm-hmm. It was a different kind of thing. There was no steam or none of those things. And the toilet facilities and these things were much better. But and of course they were not in the Joint Board of Sanitary Control. And there was no control to protect. Well, a shop foreman would help the worker, but it wasn't the way it was under Price.
Do you think that the Joint Board of Sanitary Control was effective in improving conditions?
Oh, no question about it. They did improve. They did change conditions.
Where did they have the actual legal power to fine the employees?
It was a joint agreement. Mm-hmm. It was paid for by the employers and by the union.
Mm-hmm. And the city or the state had no involvement at all in that?
What?
The city or the state had no involvement
at all? No. It was a union. It was the thing we were talking about with Tavishaw. Mm-hmm. It was an agreement for the establishment of sanitary working conditions, education, and medical examination, the whole gamut.
So it was that experience that really gave you an idea of how to establish the Workers' Bureau.
Well, that was the basis on which we said, well, this doesn't go far enough. It only applies to ladies' garment workers, and the whole question of occupational diseases and the things were coming out. That was the time when the girls in New Jersey were painting watch dials with putting the tips of the brushes in their mouths to put the, and had their whole heads, you know, cancer, the bone and everything destroyed. And these things were coming out, you know, in the newspapers. And even in New York, Fifth Avenue, if you know New York, had no transportation except buses. And the buses would just follow one another. And when they'd get to an intersection and stop, and all the exhausts were going, and the traffic cops were overcome by the fumes, and a study was made then on the effect of the emissions from automobiles on health.
And that would have been in the early 20s?
That was in the early 20s.
Now, how did you make your contact with the union in establishing the Workers' Health Bureau?
When you make a contact with them and you discuss their conditions, and the workers were dying. You saw the picture of this one, young people, and they were sick and they were overworked and they were, the spray machine was taking away jobs and they were ripe for doing some.
But you went from individual union to individual union,
mm-hmm,
and proposed.
That's right.
To help
you. And then we set up this, and you'll see it in those things I gave you to look at. And they took it over. They assessed their members so much per member to set up this research machinery. And it became nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
State federations and internationals, and we even went to the government station in Rhode Island and made a survey of the effect that was having on the workers, and they were part of that local of the machinists, was part of our committee. We went from place to place, all over the country.
I see.
Three of us.
The three of you. Now,
but with the backing of the union.
Of the union.
They set up a trade union council, which was responsible for the thing.
Now, what effect did the civil war within the trade unions in the mid-20s have on your functions and survival?
Well, that was before the AFL-CIO thing.
No, in 1923-1924, where the fight was going on between the right and the left within the union.
Well, there was always a fight between the right and the left.
Mm-hmm. What effect did it have on your work?
Well, I told you that it had no effect on the initial work that we did between 1920 and where is that book I showed you?
I looked it in.
Yeah, well, you're not to take that anymore.
Yes.
Up until that national meeting, which worried the American Federation of Labor because they thought we were getting too much power and it might have some effect on them, on their policy. And they began to pull people up.
Mm.
People out. And, you know, when the parent organization says, then that's it. You have no recourse. Because we have a whole series of letters there from our affiliated people after we were given up, saying it was a shame to have done that and should not have happened, but there's nothing you could do. And I told you that the period had changed.
Right.
It was a question of unemployment, and it was a question of survival. It was the time when people were thrown out of their homes, and the furniture was on the sidewalk, and the gas was turned off, and the water was turned off, and all these workers' councils were building up. And they couldn't, I mean, the question of whether they had a, whether they were exposed to lead, they weren't exposed to anything because they had no job. You understand that?
Yeah. Now, was there any attempt with the formation of the CIO to resurrect the workers' health?
No. The AFL-CIO was a fight between two factions of labor, and finally they amalgamated. But take the teachers' union to which I belonged. And the head of it was Hayward Broome, I guess it was.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And it was CIO at that time. And then later it became AFL-CIO.
Mm-hmm.
The newspaper guild was CIO. And we organized the Mercury and the News here, my husband. And I was one of the organizers, too, because I was working on labor papers. Yeah.
Did you have any contact with Miriam Allen DeFord?
Who?
Miriam Allen DeFord.
No.
Who wrote for the Federated Press.
Oh, well, the Federated Press was part of, we worked with Hessler.
You were working with the Federated Press also?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. With Carl Hessler.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were there,
Now, let me just
and with a railroad union, with Len Bacow.
That's when you met Len. Oh,
he was the editor of the Locomotive Engineer Journal,
mm-hmm.
and it was put out in Chicago.
Now, you went to Chicago, you remarried in 33, you stayed in New York till the death of the Workers' Health
yeah.
Bureau. And then remarried and went to Chicago. And that was McDonald, and that was Brennan. That was McDonald then.
That was McDonald.
What else? The Reese Live, there was something wrong with the tape recorder then. So that we get that.
I said that she had been one of the people, one of the volunteers at Hull House with Jane Addams. And when she married my father, she brought this whole sociological impact into the picture, which had been completely foreign to anything we'd been doing or anything like my father had been doing. He was interested in medicine, and that's what I was interested in. And one of the things she did, we used to have meetings of interested people, professors and graduate students at our home. She would bring them in. And at one of these meetings, she had the slides from Jacob Riis's, the picture he had taken on How the Other Half Lives. And that's when I was introduced to that book and saw the thing, the actual slide. That was when Lincoln Steffens, you know, was in New York, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the muckraker at that time, if you remember that. So that whole, and then in New York, we also were connected with the Unitarian Church, John Haynes Holmes. And he was part of that liberal, you know, front.
Mm-hmm.
There was a whole liberal, I wouldn't call it radical. But of course, we knew Norman Thomas, and when we did the coal mine stuff, we had that connection.
Did you have any connections in those early days with the early Socialist Party? You mentioned Deb before.
No, I was never a member of the Socialist Party. I was very interested in issues rather than in political affiliations.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how, I mean, when we started the Farm Research and Legislative Committee, this was also the same policy. We were nonpartisan and not nonprofit and interested as a coalition of rural, urban people rather than, we never came out for candidates because we would have broken the thing up. I mean, you take the man who was president of the Western Dairyman, he was a Republican. And we never asked anybody whether they were Republican or not. I guess she has what she wants. And this is what I'm against, and this is what I wrote you in the letter. I don't believe in the building up of an individual. We've never done that. And whatever we did, we were submerged in the organization. And I think there's a danger in this thing that you're doing of perpetuating individuals rather than submerging them into the period of the time and the surge of the people for particular issues. And that's why I was hesitant about mm-hmm. this whole thing, because it's against my whole policy
mm-hmm.
and against my whole life. And everything that has been done, that I have done, was part of other people. And what contribution I was able to make, I couldn't have made if it hadn't been for the other people.
No, I understand that. It's just that I...
But that's true, and I wrote you that. And I think you said, or Len said when I talked to him, well, there was Ma Bloor, and there was the mother of the miners. I've forgotten her
name.
Mother
Jones. What?
Mother Jones. Mother Jones. And the whole Women's Trade Union League. And I don't think that's true. I think that the role of women in all the movements, even going back to the Civil War and Harriet Beecher Stowe, has been significant and has been part of history.
Oh, their role has been, but they except for a few individuals like Mother Jones.
Oh no, that isn't true. They couldn't—they couldn't have operated. She couldn't have operated without the wives of the miners. They were nameless or faceless, but they are the ones that.